Welcome to a new space dedicated to biculturalism, a place to gather conversations, resources, and perspectives for everyone who wants to delve into the world of dual identity. I'm Natanya Hoffman, and you're listening to The Extra Half. Hi, everyone, and welcome to our 23rd episode. Today's guest is Simen Fegran, a wonderful horn player who is a member of the Gewandhausorchester in Leipzig, a longtime member of the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, and co-founder of the Alma Mahler Chamber Orchestra. Simen has performed extensively in Europe, North America, and Asia, and is German and Norwegian. We're really happy to have him with us today. Here's the conversation. Hi, Simen.
Hi, Natanya.
How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks so much for being a part of this project.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get right into it. When people ask you where you're from, what's the short answer? What's the long answer? And what do you usually tell people?
So the short answer is that I am German and Norwegian, living and working in Leipzig, Germany. The long answer is that my mum is half German and half Dutch, and my father is Norwegian. I feel that I am equally both, but I've always lived in Germany my whole life. And I usually tell people that I am half German and half Norwegian, even though I feel like I'm fully both.
And we were just talking before we turned on the mics about your name, which can be perhaps a little bit interesting in its translation to different languages. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'll introduce myself and say, hi, my name is Simen. And particularly if it's an English-speaking person or an English native-speaking person, I'll be scanning their face for a potential reaction to that. The name is pronounced exactly the way that you thought you heard. It's just the Norwegian version of Simon. And lots of people in Germany also get it wrong. They'll say Simon or even Simon for some reason. Some Germans like to try that one out. But very used to people getting my name wrong and also very used to having a little chat about it and the occasional joke, which is completely fine because it's, let's face it, it is hilarious. And any pun that I've not heard is very appreciated.
But that's interesting because that means that your name is then completely Norwegian, correct?
Yes, yes.
And when you are in Norway, does that mean that people assume that you've grown up there all your life? And does that ever lead to any interesting situations?
Well, people don't assume that I'm not Norwegian when I'm in Norway. I think I can confidently say that. I speak Norwegian. I sound like a Norwegian when I speak. People also, it's not a rare name in Norway by any means. So people just automatically know how to pronounce my name there.
Yeah. It's interesting because for me, sometimes I feel like when I'm speaking with Italians in Italy, I feel like it doesn't take much time before I run into something where I feel like I have to explain that I didn't go to school here or that I don't understand a cultural reference. So it's interesting for me how those two cultures, although I feel them equally within me, American and Italian, I feel like they have a very different place in my life because of where I went to school and where I was educated. So I was actually wondering what place those two cultures have inside of you, both culturally and in terms of familiarity and relationship with both of them.
Yeah, I think it's quite similar to what you're saying, is that I never lived in Norway. I didn't grow up there technically. But I do feel equally Norwegian as I feel German, and that's because I went to Norway every summer of my childhood, and I still go back every year. And because of that, it's kind of because I've always associated extremely good like memories with Norway, and of course like summer holidays or the occasional winter holiday as well. I have mostly exclusively positive feelings about Norway and about my time there. I was always very sad whenever we were leaving Norway, and there was always something inside of me that I never wanted to leave. I always thought, like, why are you leaving? You do not want to leave. And that's why I think I have this kind of unanswered question that I would really like to at least try out to live in Norway for, because I feel so good there. I feel very, very at home, even though I've technically never, lived there for longer than a summer holiday. But yeah, it's something that's on my list.
And I'm wondering, actually, linguistically, I assume that you live most of your life within three languages, which are German, Norwegian, and English. Is that more or less fair?
Yeah, that's right.
And I wonder, because they're all Germanic languages, and as I was kind of thinking about some things and preparing this podcast, I was reading that German and English are classified as West Germanic, whereas Norwegian would be North Germanic. I was wondering if you kind of feel similarities and differences between the languages, and if you even feel German and English to be more interconnected than Norwegian, and how you use these languages to attack like a fourth language, or if you're in a different place.
Well, I was aware that they're all considered Germanic languages, but and there, what actually is quite, so there's a lot of words in all of those languages that are very similar. So you might learn a new vocabulary and it just immediately makes sense because it either sounds exactly like something that you're already familiar with, or it's very close at least.
Mm.
But Norwegian and German are grammatically very different, and also the kind of feel of the languages is very different, I would say. And there's also not really, I've never thought of German and English being especially connected. But then I guess I have been rather unsuccessfully trying to learn French for quite some time. And that is actually a very different language from those three languages. So I guess maybe I'm more aware of the similarities between German, English, and Norwegian now that I'm learning a language that is, or trying to learn a language that's outside of the group of Germanic languages.
Yeah, totally. I find that to be so often the case that well, and that's kind of a life theme in a way, isn't it? That we don't realize how similar things are until we find some even bigger contrast. It's interesting because I've been teaching my neighbor English, actually, and I feel like all the time, and rightly so, I mean, it's the first time she's learning a different language, and it's like very difficult for her. But I feel like every single lesson I'm trying to tell her, like, it's just like German. It's exactly like German. And it's funny how these things work.
Yeah, well, so my girlfriend is French, and she's trying to learn German. I'm actually doing a very good job at learning German since last September. And she started from nothing. And she often has questions, of course. And I really have no experience in teaching any language, but also not in explaining German. And that can be, I guess that can be very hard for, because you get, especially in Germany from other international students, you get the question every now and then. You get a question related to the German language, and it's just, I really regret that I'm not able to explain how the German language works. And I find that quite difficult. But and I guess I try and translate a lot of things directly to English from German. And actually, you're right. It's surprising how often it works quite well to do that.
Yeah.
How old is your neighbor?
Well, let's just say that she still has her GDR driver's license that's going to expire in 2021.
Well, that's so cool.
Yeah, it was amazing when I saw it. I couldn't believe it.
Did she approach you, or how did that start?
Yes, she said that she really wanted to learn English. And, you know, I think that historically there, they learned Russian and not English. And,
right,
and I think that, yeah, it didn't really stick. Perhaps it wasn't taught well. For sure, it was that kind of corner of history for which it then didn't have very much practical use.
That's so cool, though, that she's open to, especially now, it can seem like something like a lot of people. I mean, I live in Eastern Germany where, people had Russian in school, and where the level of English amongst the older generation is definitely lower than it is in Western Germany. And yeah. I know a lot of people feel almost ashamed of it to a certain extent, because it's quite normal for the younger German generation to have a decent level of English at this point. So that's really, really cool that she's, you know, that she's trying now. That's so cool.
Yeah. And you were just starting to mention talking about East Germany. You are a horn player working in Leipzig in the Gewandhaus Orchester. And I have quite a few questions about that. This is also a really special, particular and difficult time for all musicians and orchestra musicians. But I just wanted to start first asking about this dissonance between East and West. Because if I understand correctly, you grew up in West Germany.
That's right, yeah.
And you've been living in East Germany for how long? And what have been some of the things that you've felt about these two sides of the unified country now?
Well, I've been living in East Germany ever since I moved out of my parents' place. So when I started studying, which is going to be 10 years this year, first I moved to Rostock, which is in the northeast. And then later I moved to Leipzig, where I've actually been for quite a few years now. And the difference has been much bigger than I expected. I mean, the unique history of how Germany was a divided country for almost 50 years is something that you do learn, or that I learned quite a lot about in school. But then to actually experience Eastern Germany, I mean, it's definitely a different mentality that's noticeable amongst the older generation. People can be a bit more closed in general when you meet them for the first time, also people that you might interact with in everyday life. People stare quite a lot, which can seem weird if you're not used to that. But in general, I have to say people are nice. They're just a little tougher to crack open, if that makes sense.
And I think coming to the root of that, I think it's probably important to bring World War II into this conversation. And when we were preparing this conversation, I remember that you talked about how World War II had specific and immediate effects on your family, and also perhaps some of the ramifications of those past, I guess, 85 years, and how they can also be felt in Eastern Germany, in the political situation, and in all of Germany.
Right. It was more that you asking me to be on the podcast kind of, it's inspired me to actually ask a lot of questions. I mean, World War II, I remember learning about it from my parents and my grandparents. Since always, it was something that was always talked about quite a lot in my family. I'm lucky in a sense. I don't know if lucky is the word, but I am kind of lucky that my family, especially my German side of the family, has a relationship to World War II that they can very easily talk about, or more easily than a lot of other German families, because my family, they were in no way ever supporters of the Nazis. My grandma, my mum's mum, she is from the Netherlands, and was naturally, her mum was a cafe owner in Amsterdam at the time the Nazis came to the Netherlands, and she was actually married to a German man. So that would be my, just so to keep the overview here, that's my great grandma. On my mother's side, she was married to a German man that had basically lived his whole life in the Netherlands, but was by birth German. And so she hid him on the attic of her cafe in Amsterdam for years, because he would have been drafted into the German army because he was a German man. And then my grandfather's, so my German grandfather's family, his mum was Jewish, and his father was Catholic, and his mother also converted to Catholicism when the Nazis were already in power. But that wasn't stopping the Nazis for, you know, for them it was about race and not about religion. My grandpa is by definition, technically he would have been Jewish as well, because it's something that's passed on through the mother, I believe. But since his mum was then later Catholic, he was also raised Catholic, I guess. And so they had a, because of their family history, they had a tough 12 years that the Nazis were in power. And obviously that's something that has just come up a lot, because it's just such a defining, I mean, period for, I guess, anybody who lives such times. But I'm very thankful that my family was very normal to talk about these things very early on. And I remember going to the closest concentration camp to where I grew up as well, also from a quite young age, to learn about this important part of German history. And my Norwegian family, my father's parents are a bit, they're not alive anymore, but they were a bit older than my mum's parents. So they were already teenagers, or I guess young adults, when the Nazis invaded Norway. And so they both experienced 5 years of Nazi occupation when they were, yeah, young adults already. So that's obviously also a very significant part in their life. And when my dad was coming home with a German girlfriend for the first time, my mum told me that the very first question that my Norwegian grandma asked her was, what was your family doing during the war? Which is not your most classic icebreaker, but it was understandably just very important for her to know about. And I think a lot of Germans have been less lucky in the sense that they've had parents or grandparents that have been a lot less open about their past. And, you know, then maybe a family member dies and while going through their things, there's plenty of stories like that. Then people go through their things and they might find a photo of their grandfather in like an SS uniform or something like that, something that they didn't know about at all. And I guess that must be a very difficult thing to deal with, to have the feeling that you didn't really know, or that that there was too many secrets that you didn't know about in your family.
Yeah. And what were those 5 years like in Norway when the country was occupied?
Well, the Norwegians, Norway was a neutral country in World War I, and they were planning to be neutral again in World War II. And then the German attack came completely by surprise. And Norwegians were obviously not very fond at all of the Germans. My father told me that his father, obviously this was after the war when my father was born, but that my grandfather was very good in making it clear to his kids that the Germans and the Nazis were not the same thing, which is also something that's he could have easily had a different opinion about, I guess, living through such a time.
And thinking about now the legacy that World War II and the aftermath of having the country be divided, I mean, I think that we forget too easily, just because I think that World War II in a lot of ways is kind of a way also for other countries and other peoples to feel that cathartic reckoning without having to do it themselves. And so I think that it's easy to forget in some ways that Germany lost the war and it was cut in half by the people, you know, by the Allies, and that it had to really go through a very, very long period in which two different political systems were really imposed on them. and then find its way back together not so long ago. So I was wondering if you could talk about how some of those things are also apparent in your life.
I would say that I always got the kind of the feeling that, obviously, I mean, I said I learned a lot about World War II and how it, you know, it's, I mean, in many ways, it seems like the climax of human horror. And I feel like my parents kind of, sometimes it seems like they grew up in a generation where they thought like, okay, of course there are still challenges in the world, but kind of, you know, the worst is behind us. And of course, when you also maybe look at more recent tendencies in the Western world, and you might not be so sure about that, but yeah, I would say, I mean, obviously, the Eastern Germany was a very different place than Western Germany. That was kind of, you know, very quickly opened up to the world, or to the Western world, and very, very Americanized. My father actually told me the story of he was studying at the Opera Academy in Oslo, which is like the post studies pre opera stadium of education. I don't know. And they did a trip to East Berlin at that time.
Oh wow.
And that was of course very difficult. They probably got in via some direct contacts from the Norwegian opera. And he said when they exited East Berlin through a tunnel in direction West Berlin, and they came out in West Berlin, the sun was suddenly shining. Well, it had been all gray the whole time in East Berlin. And of course, it didn't have, you know, West Berlin was full of advertisements everywhere, posters and all of that, and like the, you know, the capitalist society as we know it, and East Berlin was this for him probably quite negative contrast to that. And it's interesting because obviously in my orchestra there are still very, very many people from Eastern Germany that obviously experienced the GDR and those times, and that you can have really interesting conversations about. For instance, you know, the I don't know how much you know about the whole surveillance system that existed in yeah. Eastern Germany, like probably
Stasi.
Yeah, exactly, the Stasi, like one of the most impressive surveillance kind of setups pre-digital age.
Until Facebook,
exactly. Exactly. And they really cultivated this. You know, the government might force you to spy on your friends and your family, and you couldn't be sure if somebody else in your family was forced to do exactly the same thing. I mean, I can see how that can create a lot of suspicion towards people that you might not know, or towards something that might seem strange to you. And that's something that, I mean, Eastern Germany, especially Saxony, which is the state that I live in, is kind of notorious for, has become, unfortunately, become quite famous because it's the state in Germany where the extreme right is gets the most votes and is the most popular in Germany.
Yeah.
And this kind of suspicion towards something that you don't know is still kind of is still quite visible, I would say. It's quite different with the younger generation, I have to say. Especially Leipzig is a very I think it's the fastest growing city in Germany in terms of population. There's a lot of young people that come here, lots of young families, and that is really different, I have to say. Like the generational difference. But yeah, that's something that I don't always find easy also to be around, because it's something that's quite different from what I know and what I like.
I completely understand. And some of what you were saying just now was also making me think back to what you were talking about before in terms of people staring and people. I think that there's a different kind of collective conscience, and there's a different view, or quite literally, I guess, in terms of what our responsibilities and our connection to strangers is. It was interesting for me in Leipzig specifically, because I could feel people's eyes on me more. And it was like, wow, I'm used to people pretending I don't exist. And I'd never realized that so fundamentally.
Yeah. I mean, I agree very much with what you're saying, but it's also kind of, you know, our generation, we are very used to just, you know, borders aren't as much of a, problem in our eyes, I guess. There was very obvious physical restrictions in Eastern Germany. It makes you much more conscious of the kind of your space, if that makes sense, like the space where you belong, or the space that you're kind of restricted to. So that's also something that I have to say I find quite difficult about the current time. It's an absolutely luxury problem, but this not being able to go wherever we want at almost any time is something that we are so lucky to call normal, I think.
And also to be able to retain our identity. I mean, to be able to say that I am Italian and American, I pledge allegiance to neither country exclusively, and I can travel wherever else I want in the world. I mean, I think that's pretty unique in history. And I was actually wondering, I guess in a certain way, you are from a family that is bicultural over many generations, and you're also in an intercultural relationship yourself. I'm curious if you have some kind of thoughts about how even the concept of what that means and maybe some of the struggles that are associated with that have been different among generations.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say it's something that I've thought too much about, because obviously it's always just, it's the way it's been in my family. It's just the most normal thing for me that, to say something very cheesy here, that, you know, love doesn't know any boundaries. It's something to be very proud of also, I think. I mean, I know we talked about this in preparation for the podcast briefly, is that, you know, what is pride in terms of, you know, being proud about your nationality or something. But I think I think I am actually very proud of coming from a family where, you know, where you come from has never been much of a topic in a way. And so it just seems very natural to me to follow in the same line. It's not something that I do consciously, obvious. Like you don't choose who you fall for, but I'm very proud to keep it that way in a sense as well, I guess.
And you just started talking about pride. I think that's something that is particularly interesting. We've, you know, talked a lot about World War II and what that has implied for generations of Germans. What about the pride factor? How do you see that in Norway? How do you see that in Germany? And how have you seen that evolve throughout your lifetime?
National pride is handled very differently in Norway and Germany. In Germany, there's the obvious historical context where I think since the end of the Second World War, Germans just have been very, very careful in expressing the pride for their own nationality, which I think is a good thing. I don't know what it really means to be proud about your nationality, because we tend to be proud about things that we achieve or things that we work for ourselves, I guess. And, you know, you were just born in the country. If you're proud of the country you come from, you should be proud of your parents for giving, or your mum for giving birth to you in this country that you are proud to come from. So I've never thought of myself as being particularly proud to be either German or Norwegian. But in Norway, for instance, there is a daily display of national prides. Like, Norwegian flags go on absolutely everything in Norway. It's very common for Norwegian houses to have a flag like a flagpole, a proper flagpole, and to put up the Norwegian flag on, you know, on the national day or on somebody's birthday, for instance. Every boat that you will see in the Oslo Fjord has a Norwegian flag. It's every cucumber or tomato in the shop has a Norwegian flag on it, because they produce a lot of local stuff, which is great. But yeah, so the display of national pride is constant in Norway in a way, and it climaxes in the on the Norwegian National Day, which is the 17th of May, where there are parades all across the country where you can, it's very easy to find pictures of it. It's actually quite amazing. Like, you have the whole, all of the streets full of parades and marching bands playing, and everybody, absolutely everybody, dresses up, and there's Norwegian flag overkill. And in Germany, people, I mean, the people now, since a few years now, the people that use the German flag now, that, you know, wave it around in the street, are people that I think I would be rather critical of if I met them, because it's kind of, you know, the resurgence of kind of nationalist movements all over the Western world has brought with it also people that people like that in Germany, of course, that think there isn't enough of a display of pride being German in Germany. And I've actually always quite liked the German way to be very, very modest about it. I don't know, like, what are you, for instance, it's a thing that's obviously with the news and stuff, it's been on my mind quite a lot recently. Like, how do you feel as an American, for instance? Not so much about maybe current events is a bit easy, but just the display of, I mean, they love the word patriotism, don't they? And everybody wants to label themselves as a patriot. How's that? How do you feel about that?
Yeah. Well, there's so much there. It's a really great question. I think that there is a lot of flag waving and anthem reciting, and that was always very, very difficult for me. There are some things that are a little bit, I would say, not quite thought through about the American approach to patriotism today. And I think that, I don't know, it was really interesting, because there was a project done by the New York Times called 1619. It's a podcast, and it talks about, well, 1619 was when the first slaves landed in the United States, and slavery didn't end until the Civil War was over. And basically, it kind of talks about, well, it talks about what the transatlantic slave trade was and how much money it brought into the United States and how it turned this colony, which is, it was a colony like any other colony. I mean, the whole world was colonized. So it talks about how this colony really thrived through that trade. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that then the Trump administration, in one of its last acts, came out with the 1776 report, which was supposed to be kind of a rebuke to the New York Times. And it's fascinating in a way. I read most of it, and basically it says that slavery was unfortunately very common in that day, and it talks about how we shouldn't be trying to make people feel bad about themselves and be purposely divisive, whereas a lot of the rhetoric, like men being created equal and separation of church and state, were based in the ideology of the day, which they then framed. And of course, as a gut reaction, I completely reject the premise of that. Then there were some reviews talking about how there were no historians on the panel that created that report. And I reject the premise. But what I do understand is that human beings want desperately to see themselves in a positive light and to understand the context and to see why they acted the way they did and to move forward and turn a page without accepting guilt on a fundamental level. I find it so fascinating what did happen in Germany, because as far as I know, the German culture is the only one that has this relationship to nationalism and to its own flag and its own symbolism. And I find it a really fascinating case study in the sense that Germany lost the war, like we were talking about before. And so there was a whole lot of rhetoric that was imposed onto it. But what it did from there is, I would say, unique to the world as I know it. And I think that the fact that America and the South, which also lost a war, has continued to go on allowing Southern rhetoric and the lost cause to really motivate and have a real seat at the table in public discourse, I think that's perhaps a more common response to what happened. Like, what I mean is a more common response to the history that played out in its land in relationship to what other countries have done.
It's quite interesting, I think, that you say, you know, the South lost the war, for instance, because it's like hurt pride, if you will, is also one of the hurt national pride is one of the reasons the Nazis actually came to power.
Yes.
In the 30s, because obviously Germany had already lost the First World War.
And, yes.
And the Nazis, they abused, I mean, obviously they abused things like anti-Semitism, and they abused the hardcore inflation of the 1920s in Germany as well. But they also abused this like herd national pride that was still present from the loss of the First World War. So yeah, interesting. But for me, it's like, it really is. What's interesting for me about when I watch American politicians speak, and it doesn't matter from which side of the political spectrum they come from, really. For me, it seems so. Any American politician almost will mention at one point or another in their speech that America is the greatest country that has ever existed. And that's something that I always have a reaction to, I have to say. And when you, I mean, it's an extreme example, but when you see the American people storming the Capitol, which is a recent event, shouting USA, USA, I guess that's something that they like to do in many different contexts as well. But just for me, just if I were to replace that with people screaming Deutschland, Deutschland, but what that would do to not just what that means to me, but that would what effect that would have on so many other people. I think that would be such a strong impact. And for some reason, it's not very different, I think, especially in a, like, for instance, the kind of patriotism or love for the country that I talked about for Norway. Always comes with it. It's never threatening to me. Well, it's never seemed threatening. Although I'm sure there are certain people that absolutely take it too far in Norway as well. It's because the country is so small, and it's something that I feel I also get an uneasy reaction to when I see the American display of yeah, nationalism or patriotism, if they prefer that word. So yeah, I guess German people, there's no need for German people now to feel actively guilty about something that happened 75, 80 years ago. I don't think that's what people are not asking for a rewrite of American history, I think. You don't have to feel being conscious of the past of your country and remembering the dark times in the past of your country does not mean you have to feel guilty about your country. You don't have to feel guilty for other people's actions.
And I think that's so important, what you just said. I think that a lot of times we feel that we should feel guilty, or people are asking us to feel guilty. And I definitely felt that myself in the last several months in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd. But now I've come to a place where I personally think that nobody's asking me to feel guilty. If anything, people are asking me me to understand and then to act, but not to feel guilty. I mean, who is that going to help? Like,
yeah, also guilt doesn't really create anything, I think. Guilt is just guilt. And the point of being conscious of past mistakes is that the point is to move forward from that and learn from that. And that's also the reason it's important to really face your past, I think, so that you do end up learning from it.
Absolutely. Well, with complete lack of knowledge on how to make a proper segue, I believe you've prepared a little excerpt of No, I'm so sorry, but like
No, that's so good. Oh, please leave it in unedited like this.
I'll try.
Oh, that was the most perfect transition ever.
And so have you thought about something that you would like for us to hear of your playing?
So we are going to listen to a recording of the evening prayer from the opera Hänsel und Gretel by Engelbert Humperdinck. This is a recording that the horn section from my orchestra did with the horn section from the Boston Symphony Orchestra last December as sort of a little Christmas greeting. Our two orchestras, we share the same chief conductor, and there is a cooperation going on between the two orchestras. In 2019, we went to Boston with the orchestra from Leipzig to play a concert with both orchestras on the same stage. And it's been nice to kind of keep this cooperation going in these times with the Boston people.
So how did music become a part of your life? When did you start playing the horn?
I started playing the horn when I was 6 years old. My parents are both opera singers. So music was always there. And me picking up an instrument was something that was also sort of a given thing. I wanted to play percussion. But a kindergarten friend of me decided to start playing the horn, and I said, me too, and that's why I play the horn. And so I started when I was six, and there was always music at home, and my parents were both freelance opera singers. I got to travel quite a lot as a child, got to travel with them to different opera productions that they had. So music was always there, but I didn't really listen to music myself, I would say, and wasn't especially ambitious on the horn either. And I started listening to music when I discovered punk rock when I was about 12 years old, I think. And I kept playing the horn somehow never really quit and always kept doing it on the side. And then entered kind of the first symphony orchestra, the youth orchestra of the state that I'm from in Germany. I think it's kind of a similar story for many orchestra musicians. That was kind of my moment where I realized that having goosebumps in music was something that wasn't just a saying, but it was actually a physical experience that you could have. And I was 15, I think, and that's when I started to practice and to take it seriously with ambitions to later study it. And then it was, of course, also very easy with my parents. It was never something that was always something that they completely understood, of course. And at the same time, I have the feeling that it's a path that I did discover on my own for myself, even though my parents were very supportive, of course, when I had decided on that.
Yeah. And something that you touched on briefly earlier in this conversation is how international the music world is. Just as an example, I mean, the way that we met is through your wonderful, amazing girlfriend, Rafael. I met her in the United States. You met her on tour all throughout Europe in an orchestra that's quite amazing. I mean, the Gustav Mahler Jugendorchester was also, for me, the first time that I even remember on my first tour, I was thinking, why does the human need so many emotions? Like,
we don't. That's amazing. Oh, that's so well put.
It was overwhelming to the point of confusion, but it was incredible.
When did you do it?
I was there in 2012. I did two tours.
Okay. I started in 2014.
Ah. Yeah. And so, I mean, these are, you know, even within these two relationships, we're talking about two continents and a dozen countries. What is it like actually for you as an international person to be in such an international scene? And do you feel like speaking multiple languages and understanding multiple realities is concretely helpful?
Yeah, well, I think that the international aspect is hands down the coolest thing about the music world. And it's already, I mean, from my very first orchestral experience, I thought that was the most amazing thing. The concept of, you know, 100 different people getting together and somehow it works. It really shouldn't, but somehow it works. And I had I would say life-changing experience with the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, because the 100 people that come together when it's international are even more different than they already are when it's, for instance, a German youth orchestra. And I think that is, I'll never get tired of that. And for me, that really was, for me, there is a before and an after Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, both in terms of how I view the music world, but also just in terms of the level that I played on. For me, it was a youth orchestra that I knew about well before I started studying even. And I thought, okay, even if you get really good, there's no way you're ever going to be a part of that. And then suddenly you're there, and it's the most intense experience. I have so many small memories. I don't know if that's the same for you, but yeah. Just even though you're exhausted basically the whole time for 6 weeks, because it's so much rehearsing and in general not that much sleep. Even though you're so exhausted, I at least experienced this time as I was so awake at the same time, and I always came home extremely motivated, extremely inspired, and this is only heightened, I feel, by the international aspect, and I couldn't really say if my bicultural background gave me an easier access to that. I would say the coolest thing in general, well, that's how I experienced orchestra when I was 15 for the first time. It was like, you know how in school, for instance, I experienced it as very, there was lots of like cliques and groups in school. And then in the orchestra, even the people that you thought might have been more kind of outsiders, in school, they were part of the thing of the orchestra. It was never, because it's a cliche to say this, but really just connected by the love for music. It really, really doesn't matter who you are or where you're from.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I think that it's such a glue. It's such an incredible glue to be able to be with people day in and day out and then just share this experience that is not attached to words. It's not attached to our usual ways of processing experiences. It's just something altogether different.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't you feel like it's something that other people, even like non-professional musicians, should experience?
Yeah.
I think honestly, it would be good for everybody. We wouldn't have any wars if everybody just did it all with an international youth orchestra once in their life, I think.
Absolutely.
I think you can also make a connection to what we said about nationalism or, you know, belonging to a different country. I think a sense of community. I think you're absolutely right. That's what everybody craves. And the amazing thing for me about the community that an orchestra can create is that it's so inclusive, whereas in terms of countries or nationalism, it's sort of more about who is not part of the group, you know, if that makes sense.
Because that defines the group. Yeah. You need a them to have an us. That's absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And what was it like then for you moving out of these first experiences, first with the German Youth Orchestra and then with this International European Youth Orchestra and then going to the Gewandhaus? Was it your first experience working in a professional orchestra or was there another one before that?
I've done a bit of guest work in different German orchestras, and I also had a temporary contract at the opera in Hannover for about 6 months. But then I started, actually my relationship with the Gewandhaus Orchestra has been going on for about 5 years now, I think, because I did what's called the Orchestra Academy first, which is sort of a program that some German orchestras have where you essentially get to work in the orchestra for 2 years and do about maybe 50% of what a regular member of the orchestra would do. And you also get lessons from members of the orchestra and do chamber music with the other academists. And generally there's one academist per section in the orchestra. So I got to do that for 2 years. And after that, I also had a temporary contract in the orchestra when my time as an academist was up. And then by chance, there was a colleague who quit his job in the orchestra. And I had the opportunity that suddenly there was an open position. And I got this position. Yeah, and I cool. also scored the complete jackpot in that I passed my trial year. So after you pass an audition, after you win a position in an orchestra in Germany, you have to do what's called a trial year. And I passed this trial year 2 weeks before we stopped playing.
Congratulations! That's incredible.
Yeah, thank you. It's As a musician, I've probably been, or I have to say that I've been amongst the most privileged you can be in this time, because I have the security of a fixed position, and
so then right after that, you had to stop playing for how long?
The orchestra didn't play before September, I think, properly. So that was 6 months, and even then it was only 2 months in which we were allowed to play concerts again, in, you know, reduced programming and reduced concert audience, of course very strict rules. But the first kind of 6 months, The orchestra took its role as kind of a cultural ambassador for the city very seriously, I think. So we used every opportunity to play outside of hospitals or to play outside of retirement homes. And that's something that we can kind of forget also in the everyday life in the orchestra sometimes, which is quite a machine that never stops, if you will. That's we can achieve very much with very little sometimes as well. And just being there for the citizens, we got some really moving responses from people for that. And it's also in a time, I mean, now it's always almost been a year where the whole cultural sector has, in Germany at least, by the German government, been defined as nicht systemrelevant, which is their term that they use for non-essential, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great not system relevant. See how German is similar to English.
Yeah, not relevant to the system. Yeah. And even if I'm an extremely privileged musician in this time, of course it's difficult to live with this kind of in the back of your head for almost a year. That's you know, you're being classified as not relevant enough. And these kind of small formats that we did, they were very important for us too, I think, these small concerts, getting the immediate reaction from people and realizing that, no, actually it is very important what we do. I mean, that's something that we believe anyways, I think, but it's sometimes you need other people to confirm it for you as well.
Yeah. Well, in a conversation that has been marked for me by really, really wonderful moments and really awkward transitions, if there is any advice that you might have for someone who is young and bicultural and perhaps missing one of the two countries that's not accessible, or perhaps wondering why they don't exactly fit in and not having an orchestra to be able to find a connection with, is there anything that you might say?
In terms of mature advice, I can't even grow a beard yet, so don't take it too seriously, maybe, what the advice that I can give. But the way I see it, having two or more cultures as part of your identity is only an advantage and is only a gift. Because of that extra perspective that it gives you. And then if there might be moments where you feel like you are struggling with not being accepted for one or two nationalities that you might hold or whatever background you have, I think it's also very important to remember that our nationality or our nationalities is just one small part of who we are as people.
Well, but the fact that you talked about giving mature advice begs the question as to what your immature advice would be.
Okay, that's very good. My immature advice would be to check out the movie Batman Begins, where Batman says, it's not who I am underneath, it's what I do that defines me. And then he jumps off a building and is really epic and stuff. And I mean, that's good advice. Be like Batman.
Absolutely. Steven, it's been so great. It's been wonderful talking to you. And I've really, really enjoyed this opportunity to think a little bit more about some of these things which we live with all the time and we maybe don't talk about enough.
It's been the same for me. As I said, it's just you asking me to do this has it already triggered a lot of thinking for me, and I've been asking my parents quite a few questions, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
The Extra Half is created and produced by a small but dedicated team. Thank you to Jilvinas Brazauskas and to Jessamine Jones. Would you like to get involved? You can send us a message at theextrahalf@gmail.com. Support us at patreon.com/theextrahalf. Rate and review this podcast, or find us on Facebook and Instagram. Don't forget to share your favorite episode with a friend, family member, or on social media. I'm Natanya Hoffman. You've been listening to The Extra Half. Take care. Until next time.